Welcome, everybody, to State of Murder. We are on episode 13 14. Damn it.
I'm pretty sure, because I think North Dakota was 12 and South Dakota was 13.
You are correct on that, so... My days are continuing to blend together, and how many episodes we've done. I feel like I should write it down and have like a list
and just be like, do, 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 do. Yeah.
Yep, there we go. But this week, we are in a very special place.
We are. We are in my home state of Nebraska.
Yeah, so we made it.
We did. We made it to the Cornhusker State. I was really, really excited about making it to my state. That sounds weird when you're like, ooh, I'm excited to share murders that happened in my hometown. But I have to admit, I am super excited.
Yeah, but I'm super excited that we are here in Nebraska too. And again, shocker of shockers, not a state I have been to. So we did not meet in Nebraska. That's for sure.
No, that is for sure. Sadly, you would stick out like a sore thumb in Nebraska.
I do not doubt that at all.
In many places in Nebraska.
In many places, I think, in the Midwest, in the South, there'd be a whole bunch of places. I want to say one of my cousins went to one of the Carolinas to visit a friend, and she was like, I was the only brown person in that place. And me and my family, anyone who knows me or has seen my picture on the blog, I am not a very dark skinned.
No.
And neither is my cousin. So for us to stand out, it's like, they got some pale people there, if that's standing out like that.
Well, if you see me, I'm pretty par for the course when it comes to Nebraska. I do not stick out like a sore thumb there. I stick out like a sore thumb around here because everybody's very short in this town.
Yes, you are very tall.
And I'm tall. Oh, but yeah, no, I'm excited to be in Nebraska.
Yeah, me too. We got some good stories. My story came from your dad.
Yes.
So that was nice. Our first referral.
That was nice. Yeah, definitely. He was real quick with that one. So
yeah, and it was a very interesting case. So I'm excited to talk about it today.
So I don't know if you look up the Lincoln Journal Star on that case. Well, I'll talk about it when it comes to you. But yeah, I do know this is, I mean, rarely do I know the cases that Selena shares, but obviously my dad shared this one. So I am familiar with, I don't know everything about it. So I'm interested to hear your take on it, but I do know some of the background on that case. And, you know, a lot of cases in Nebraska, I probably would have heard of at least something, some of it. So
yeah, but let's get started with your story this week. I'm excited because you've been excited since episode one. Like, yeah. I think even before we started the podcast, you're like, I know what we're doing for Nebraska.
So. Yeah, definitely. So I know that as we stated when we were, like, even when we first began, that we were crossing the country, we're going to focus a lot on lesser known crimes. So, however, if you do listen to our first episode of State of Murder and Selena and are kind of introducing ourselves and how we got into following true crime cases, I stated that there was one very specific case that really drew my attention. So during that episode, I didn't share with you guys what the murder case was, but we have finally reached my home state of Nebraska. And today I'm going to share with you the story that riveted to the TV when I was 13 years old. This didn't happen when I was 13 years old, but there was a made-for-TV movie that covered this story when I was 13.
Okay.
And it was called Murder in the Heartland. Now, this case definitely isn't lesser known. It is not only well known in Nebraska, but it is well known pretty much everywhere if you talk to probably a certain age person. So Bruce Springsteen wrote his 1982 album, Nebraska, completely based off of this case. Stephen King, this I think will interest you, Selena, has based a lot of characters off of the case we're going to talk about, especially some, I don't remember the name of the character, but in The Stand, one of the characters is based off of him. And also just Stephen King's kind of interest in macabre and horror stemmed from this case.
Okay.
It totally is what piqued his interest in murder as a boy. There's been a ton of Hollywood movies and characters based off of this murderer. So today I'm going to tell you guys all about Charles Starkweather. I'll refer to him as Charlie, and Carol Ann Fugate. Charlie was born on November 24th, 1938 in Lincoln, Nebraska. He was the third of seven children. His family was considered kind of middle class, as they always had food and shelter, although Charlie's dad was often out of work as he was a carpenter and he had severe arthritis, so it was pretty painful for him to work. When he couldn't work, his mother would waitress so the family would have some income. Charlie was born with genuvarum, which is a birth defect that caused his legs to be misshapen, so they were pretty bowed out, and he suffered from a pretty severe stutter when he was growing up. As we have mentioned time and time again, some kids can be kind of asshole.
Yeah.
I know,
I mentioned North Dakota.
Yes.
How much of an asshole the kids were for making fun of the
baby Emma.
The baby?
Yeah, baby Emma, because her
family was murdered.
Yes, exactly. So we know that kids can be bullied. Obviously, in today's society, we know that adults can be bullies and assholes too, but, you know, kids can pick on kids and be really mean. And so due to a stutter, he was teased a lot at school. Charlie hated school and he didn't excel at it. It was later discovered that he actually suffered from severe nearsightedness and he didn't have glasses. So that might be one of the reasons why he struggled so much as a kid in school. I mean, if you can't see, I remember getting glasses for the first time when I was 12 and it was just night and day because I could finally see the blackboard, which I hadn't been able to see for years. It was just a blur. And so that I can imagine would have been quite the struggle. Yeah.
That's how they figured out I needed glasses in like fourth grade because my grades started dropping and they noticed that it was because I couldn't see. I was squinting a lot because I couldn't see. So that's how they noticed.
Yep. So, I mean, there are things that we notice now that maybe back in those days weren't as prevalent. Mm-hmm. Charlie, however, did like gym class, which kind of surprised me when I read that because he had his legs had a little misshapenness. So, but hey, he excelled. So there he was able to express his rages. He had a lot of anger. And so during gym, he would start bullying other people. His friends remember that he could be a very, very nice guy, but if he thought you were bigger or stronger or better looking, he would try to make you feel significantly smaller. Okay, so I was surprised that Charlie was pretty into gym just because the fact that he did have some leg deformities, which I would imagine would make physical education a little difficult, but he actually really liked it because he was able to take out his rages. So he had a lot of anger issues, and so he was able to kind of express that in gym class, and that's where he learned how to start. He started kind of bullying people because all of a sudden he was a little bit stronger than others in the class, and so he started, you know, kicking out his aggressions. His friends remember that he could be very nice, but if he thought you were bigger, stronger, or better looking than he was, he would try to make you feel smaller.
So definitely a bully at that point.
Oh, yeah. Charlie totally looked up to James Dean and started to emulate and dress like him, especially when he went and saw the movie Rebel Without a Cause, very iconic James Dean movie, totally identifying with Dean's character in the movie. So he totally dressed like, if you see, I'll put pictures up of Charlie on our website and you will definitely see kind of the way he dressed and the way he wore his hair and everything was very James Dean-like. Charlie had one close friend, Bob Van Bush. Now, during their senior year of high school, Bob started dating Barbara Fugate. And Barbara had a little sister who had just turned 13. And this girl caught the eye of Charlie. This little girl's name was Carol Ann. Soon, the two couples started to go out on double dates together.
It was Charlie's senior year and the sister was 13?
Yeah, so she was in middle school and he was a senior in high school.
So he was like 18. 17, 18?
No, he was 18. Yeah.
And she was 13.
Yes, I know.
And everyone's just okay with it.
So
what year are we in at this point?
This was his senior year. So it would have been 1956, 57-ish. So in the 50s.
God damn it.
I know.
Okay. Ignoring the child abuse.
Yeah. Okay. Absolutely.
Pedophilia.
Absolutely. We'll have some more discussions on your feelings towards a lot of things because I have a lot of feelings towards this case. So okay. Now Carol Ann, she was a pretty girl with brown hair, and many said that she looked older than her 13 years, which, okay, that doesn't matter. She's still only 13. Child. Yeah. She also didn't do very well in school, having to repeat a grade in elementary school, but none of this mattered for Charlie. He would do apparently anything for Carol Ann, and she was really taken with his looks, his car, the way he dressed, and the fact that he would buy her things, which totally sounds like important things that a 13-year-old would be like, that's what I want in a boyfriend.
Yeah.
You know, oh, he buys me shiny things. So I did never describe Charlie. He was like 5'5". He was okay built. He had red hair. He was short. Some people consider him good looking. I will admit, when the movie came out and I started to, like, my 13-year-old self could see, you know, kind of this rebel, like, I could see how she...
Wasn't that the actor, though?
Yeah, but yes.
You're attracted to the actor.
I was. That is true.
To the murderer.
I know,
don't
but
being attracted to no, murderers.
I know.
Up on the Ted Bundy train.
No, I won't. I won't. But like, I could see at 13, I could see the draw that he would have just if this actor portrayed him in a correct way. Like, I could see how she would be drawn to him because I was 13 when that movie came out. And so I really was like, okay, so I could see it. I'm not being Patrick Hines from True Crime Obsessed. True Crime Obsessed. It's like everybody's hot.
But no, I see your point. Because also too, you think about it at 13, when an older boy pays attention to you and they're starting to be really nice to you, it's like, oh, how do they notice me? Like, I mean, I get it.
So. Yeah. So I'm just like saying that I kind of identify, like, okay, I can see the attraction, but Charlie was also very taken with Carol Ann. She meant the world to him. She had really become the most important thing in his life. Charlie ended up dropping out of high school his senior year and ended up taking a job at the Western Union newspaper warehouse. He took the job actually because it was so close to Carol Ann's middle school. And he could see her every day. So he'd be able to be like right where she is.
Okay.
However, his boss was not impressed with him and stated that he would always have to repeat what he told Charlie to do 3-4 times before he could actually understand it. And that Charlie was the dumbest employee he had ever had working there. So cool. This job didn't last long. And soon Charlie quit and took a job as a garbage man. When out on his route, Charlie started planning. First thinking about how he could rob banks, and then he started thinking how people treated him and how he felt lower than, you know, like he was just kind of treated like lower class citizen almost, and like people made fun of him growing up. So then Charlie thought, dead people are always on the same level. So once you're dead, you're dead. Like, yeah, there's no like hierarchy, nobody's better than anybody else, dead is dead.
Yeah, that's a weird way to look at it, but I get it. Because, I mean, it's not wrong.
No. So on November 30th, 1957, Charlie went to a service station. So at this time, he and Carol had been dating for about a year. So she's 14 now. So Charlie.
Child.
Oh, yeah. So Charlie went to a service station to buy Carol Ann a present of a stuffed animal shaped like a dog. However, Charlie didn't have any money to purchase this item. So he wanted to buy it on store credit. The gas station attendant named Robert Colvert refused to sell it to him or give him any store credit. So Charlie left enraged. So on December 1st, Charlie went to the gas station around 3 a.m. The first thing he did was he went and bought a pack of cigarettes. He then left and returned again and bought a pack of gum. He then left again, only to turn back around, cover his face with a red bandana. He took out his shotgun and robbed the store for $100, which apparently was mostly in coins, so not dollar bills.
Well, you think about for the day and age, everything
is
probably like a quarter or a dime or a nickel.
But I was
like,
just thinking how much that would be in change and how heavy it would be, but okay.
So much weight.
Yeah. He then forced Colvert into his car, drove him out to a remote location. Then he had Colvert get out of the car, and apparently this is what, you know, yet again, we always talk about this and how we get the stories we do. And a lot of the times it comes from the murderer themselves. This is Charlie's rendition of it. So when Colvert got out of the car, they ended up fighting over the shotgun, which ended up going off and shooting Colvert in the kneecap. Then Charlie decided he was going to take care of it, so he shot him in the head. Colvert was only 21 years old when he died, and he left behind a wife and daughter.
Aww.
Charlie was really worried about being caught after this, so he ended up changing the color of his car by painting over it. However, the police were at a loss. There wasn't a lot of crime in Nebraska at this time, or not a lot of murders. The police thought it was a transient who had killed Colvert, so Charlie had felt a sense of power at getting away with the killing. He described it as he didn't use the word euphoric, but, you know, kind of this like all-powerful high, because he now had money. He ended up killing somebody, so kind of like exerting that power over somebody and having like the ultimate control over them by taking their lives. And he had his girl. So he thought he had it all. However, this feeling didn't last that long. Now, Charlie reports that he told Carol Ann that he had been involved in this robbery, but that he wasn't the one that was responsible for killing Colvert, and that he didn't think that Carol Ann believed him. So he thought that Carol Ann totally thought he killed this guy. We don't know if that's true, but that's what he says. But by January of 1958, things were not going well for Charlie. He had been kicked out of his apartment because he had lost his job and he couldn't pay rent. And his family and Carol Ann's family were against their relationship and apparently were trying to break them up. Apparently, Carol Ann had put on a little bit of weight and her family thought she might be pregnant.
So they're bothered by the fact that she's pregnant and not by the fact that she is dating a full-grown man.
Yeah.
Now it's a problem because she's pregnant, not earlier, when this whole thing should have been stopped way before.
Oh, yeah.
Also, like that on her sister for introducing your 13-year-old child sister to,
yeah.
Because at this point, I know she's technically a preteen or a teenager. No, she's a child.
No, she's still a child.
Full grown adult.
Yeah. Now, this is where things become a little unclear as to what happened. There are facts that we know for sure, but there are things that only Carol Ann and Charlie would know the actual truth to. So I'm going to share with you what we do know. And then also I'm going to share with you from time to time Charlie's side of the story and a little bit from Carol Ann's point of view or what she also shared. What we do know is that on January 21st, Charlie went to Carol Ann's house. And inside her house were Carol Ann's mother, Velda Bartlett, her stepfather, Marion Bartlett, and her half-sister, who was about 2.5 years old, Betty Jean. Now, Charlie says he went there to try to repair his relationship with the family and to go take the stepfather out hunting, but that didn't apparently go according to plan. The family, when he got there, wanted him to leave and never wanted to see Carol Ann again. So Charlie did state that both Velda and Marion got violent. So apparently Velda hit him over the head a couple of times and Marion actually kicked him out physically out of the house.
As one should to a pedophile.
Get the fuck out of here, Charlie. So Charlie then went to a nearby payphone and ended up calling Marion's employer and said that he wouldn't be coming in for a couple of days because he had the flu. Charlie then went back to the house where he and Velda apparently started fighting again because Velda thought that Charlie had gotten Carol Ann pregnant, and so they were fighting. And Marion came out with a claw hammer. And so, like, Velda and him are fighting. And then Marion comes out. And so Charlie turns around because he thinks he's being attacked and ends up shooting Carol Ann's stepfather in the head. And then he turned and he shot Velda in the head as well. And then beat her multiple times in the head with, now I know what it's called, the butt of the gun. So at this point, little baby Jean was crying. So Charlie picked up a knife and threw it at her and it landed in her throat.
Oh my God.
Like, Charlie then went and checked to see if Marion was dead and noticed that he was still breathing. So he stabbed him multiple times as well. And then Charlie ended up dragging Velda outside into the outhouse where he ended up throwing her down the hole. He then also took Betty Jean out and put her in the outhouse and then took Marion's body and put it in the chicken coop. So we know that the wounds on the bodies and where they were found actually did happen. So that part of the story, like their wounds, how they died, where they're found, everything. What is different is the telling of this case is if you decide if you believe what Charlie ended up changing his story to, or do you believe Carol Ann's version? So by the end of everything, Charlie stated that Carol Ann had been there the entire time the murders occurred, so she knew all about it. Carol Ann states that when she ended up getting home from school that day, Charlie was there at the door and ended up shoving a shotgun in her face and threatened to kill her family if she didn't do what he said. Now, I mean, we know that Charlie did take the bodies out of the house and put them kind of outside, so that could be. When friends and family and even the police and Marion's employer came by to check on the family that week, Carol Ann would answer the door and give many different stories on why they couldn't come in. Some people, she would say that her family was very ill, that they were so sick they couldn't get out of bed, and to come back later when they were feeling better. Others, she told, if they didn't leave, that her mom would be hurt, so they needed to just go away. So her sister ended up marrying Charlie's best friend, that they double dated with. Her sister came, she wouldn't let her in. She told her, like, there was something going on, so, like, they called the police. The police came and checked on her. Days would pass, and the police went out, and they believed her story that nothing was wrong, that the family was just sick. They didn't go inside the house to see what was going on. They're just like, okay, seems checked out, we're good. It finally took her grandma coming to see what was happening. And Carol again told her, no, you can't come in. And she's like, I know. Some of them called Charlie Chuck, that Chuck was in there and she wanted him to come out. She knew something was going on. And Carol said, no. Caroline was like, no, you can't come in. Something bad will happen if you come in. And so they finally ended up calling the police again. And they went and looked inside the house, like inside the windows, but they didn't see anything. So they were like, no, nothing's wrong. They were just like, okay.
So the police just came and looked around the windows?
Yeah.
They didn't in the house?
Yep.
Okay.
So it would finally take her brother-in-law, so Charlie's best friend, to find the bodies of the Bartlett family for anyone to know their terrible fate. But by that time, Charlie and Carol Ann had gone on the run.
Oh, okay.
Charlie knew that his car wouldn't get them very far because it was pretty old and run down. The tires had been pretty flat, so he'd repaired one of them, but he was like, this isn't going to get me anywhere. So he decided that they would go to Charlie's really good friend's house. He was 72 years old, and his name was August Meyer. Now, by all accounts, Meyer was a really friendly bachelor who had known Charlie most of his life. So Charlie would go and hunting with him. He'd even taken Carol Ann out to the house to go shoot guns, which she said that she hated. She hated guns. She got physically ill when she shot the gun. But okay. So she knew who August Meyer was. According to Charlie, when they arrived at August's house, he had to end up killing August in self-defense because August tried to shoot him. Also, a side note that Charlie also shot August's dog. He was just injured, though. You know how we feel about animals.
But
so.
Still.
Yeah.
But also, too, like, why would he have to kill his friend?
So, Charlie
no
said
way the friend could have known.
Well, and I'm like, why would his friend, who's known him since he was a kid, he doesn't know anything has happened. Like the murders have happened from then. Like, why would he see Charlie walking up the road and just shoot at him? He knows who he is. So they're friends.
It sounds like Charlie just needed to kill somebody else.
Yep. So Charles put August's body in an outbuilding and Carol Ann, and he went inside the house, apparently robbed it and ate some food. So the reason why Charlie walked up to the house and didn't drive up to the house is because while they were driving up a lot of Nebraska roads, I lived on a dirt road in Nebraska, so they're not paved, so they get really muddy, especially like in the wintertime because it snows and then the snow melts. So their car had actually gotten stuck, like driving to August's house. So when they were leaving, they needed help getting their car that had been stuck out of the mud. So somebody helped push it, so they were good to go. However, they didn't drive very far when their car got stuck in the mud again. So this time, they decided to leave the car and try to hitchhike. That's when 17-year-old Robert Jensen and his girlfriend Carol King stopped and offered them help. Little did they know
Carol
that the
King?
Uh-huh.
Like, isn't that a singer?
Yeah.
Is this the singer?
No.
Sorry, I was just like
yeah,
famous
I know.
Singer? Okay.
Yeah, no. So little did this couple know that they were picking up people wanted for murder. So when Charlie got into the car, he ended up holding his gun to Jensen's neck and made him drive back towards August's house. When they arrived at a storm cellar that Charlie knew about, Charlie shot Jensen 6 times and ended up shooting King once in the head. When her body was found, she was found with her jeans and underwear down around her ankles, and she had been stabbed in her stomach and pubic area multiple times.
Oh my God.
They believe she was probably raped, but there was no semen found on her body. And I think just because there was so much damage, it was just hard to tell.
Now, yet also, it's the 50s. They don't really have DNA or things like that.
Yeah. Now, yet again, there are two sides to what happens in the story. So Carol Ann states that while all this was going on, she was in the car. Charlie says that Carol Ann was the one who stabbed King because she got so mad that Charlie was sexually attracted to another woman.
Okay.
What we do know is that these two were left in the storm cellar, and Charlie and Carol Ann took off in Jensen's car. And instead of leaving the state, like some people assumed that they would, Charlie ended up driving back to Lincoln. So all of this happened in a town called, well, not all of this. So Carol Ann's family was killed in Lincoln. And then August lived in a town just a little bit southeast of Lincoln called Bennett.
Okay. So now they're headed back to where they're wanted for murder.
Yes. So you would think that they would try to be on the run, but that didn't happen. It wasn't long before Charlie's car was discovered at August's house, and the body of August, Robert Jensen, and Carol King were discovered. The manhunt started to escalate for the two. The next stop was a very affluent neighborhood in Lincoln. So there's definitely the good side of town in Lincoln and the bad side of town. O Street divides it. So these people lived on the south side of town, which is the good side of town. Charlie knew of this neighborhood because it used to be on his garbage route. He had some time to plan on where he was going. So they ended up going to see Lauer Ward's home. He was the president of the Capital Bridge and Capital Steel Companies. So he was very well off. He was actually a very good friend of the Nebraska governor's. That day, Ward's wife Clara and their maid Lillian were home with the dogs. Charlie ended up going to the door, and when Lillian, the maid, answered it, he pointed a gun at her and entered. Lillian was, I don't know if she was deaf or just severely hard of hearing, but you had to write things down for her, just a side note. So there doesn't really play a part into anything, but just I thought it was interesting. I wonder how they communicated. Yeah. He had Carol Ann come in, and they ended up eating the breakfast that Mrs. Ward fixed for them. And Carol Ann went into the library and ended up taking a nap. I think that Charlie picked this house because he wanted these affluent people to serve him.
Yeah, because he's all about control and about people feeling
and status. Him. Yes. Mm-hmm. So I think that that definitely fit in with his, like why he's choosing some of the people he's choosing. Not really necessarily. Some are opportunity, but.
Yeah.
So around 1 p.m., Mrs. Ward went upstairs. She told Charlie she wanted to change her shoes. And so he was like, okay, yeah, go ahead. But he ended up following her when she didn't come back down. He stated that when he got to her room, she turned around and actually shot a .22 gun at him, but missed. So he ended up stabbing her multiple times. After he killed Mrs. Ward, he ended up actually calling his father just so he could warn Carol's sister and brother-in-law that they needed to watch their backs because he was going to come after them.
Okay. That's nice.
Yeah. So, and then he ended up writing down a confession of sorts, which he stated, and I'm going to read it here. I and Carol are sorry for what has happened because I have hurt everybody, case of it, and so has Carol. But I'm saying on this, everybody then out can out there was lucky. There was not dead, even Carol's sister.
Was that in English? I
don't. Not really. So pretty much.
So many words missing. It reminds me of that scene from The Office. Have you ever seen where Kevin's like, no say lot word when few words do. Like,
yes. Yes.
Not making sense.
Yeah. So it pretty much, like if you kind of read and try to figure out what he's saying, is that he's sorry that he had to do it and that he's lucky that Carol's sister's not dead.
She's lucky she didn't get murdered. Okay.
Yeah, pretty much. Charlie then tied Lillian to the bedpost and also stabbed her to death. Later, Charlie would state that Carol Ann killed Lillian. And then before they left that night, Mr. Ward actually came back home and Charlie ended up shooting him on the front steps of his house. That's when shit really hit the fan. Because
that's interesting. Really quick, because I'm noticing it. Because with the last couple, Carol King and her boyfriend, right? It was her boyfriend.
Yes.
It seemed like, well, I guess there was some overkill on the woman, but wasn't he shot multiple times, the boyfriend?
Yes, he was shot 6 times.
So to me, that makes sense because I'm like, okay, he wants to assert that he's like powerful and he's this, so he's going to overkill on the guys. But this is weird too, because like the way he shot the Mrs. Ward, right? He shot her a bunch of times. So I don't,
No, he stabbed. Like he stabbed Mrs. Ward. He
stabs her. That's right.
He stabs her multiple times. He's stab happy too, because he stabbed the stepfather.
And then with the guys, he's shooting them, right? And then
For the stepdad, he shot him. For the 17-year-old Jensen boy, he shot him. He shot the store garage attendant that started all of this. So
it seems like he's more using the guns, which are very like, I don't know. To me, that seems way more powerful. Like, look at me, because it creates such a bigger.
Yeah, but it's also a little more impersonal. And like stabbing is so personal. Yeah. That's because you're getting in there and it's close. So.
Sorry. I was just noticing it. I was like, oh, that's really interesting. But for a second, I thought he was overkilling on the women, not the men. But now it's kind of both,
I think. So he just
different methods.
Yeah. So at this time, shit was hitting the fan prior to this, especially while this is all going on, the bodies of August and Jensen and Carol King have been found. And so like the fact that she was mutilated violated in such a way, that really infuriated everybody. But then now you've killed the governor's really close friends. So it was like, holy shit. Everyone in Nebraska was up in arms. I was talking with my dad about this case as well as his siblings. So they always Zoom every month. And so we were talking about it. And the older brothers and my dad, my mom was a little bit too young. So she was only about 6 when this happened. So my dad was 12 when this happened. So he was close to Carol Ann's age.
Okay.
So this is like a very pivotal moment that he remembers. And then he has 2 older brothers. So they all remember this. And my dad
Live in Lincoln?
No, they lived in a small town about 60 miles west of Lincoln.
Okay. Cause I was like, I thought they lived in a smaller town. Yeah,
so they lived in a small town, but this was cause nobody knew where they had gone. So
it was like all in Nebraska here.
Yeah. So where are they going next? And like they hit a small town already. So my dad said this is the first time. I was actually going to have him come in and talk about it. But I don't know if I ever mentioned on this podcast, my dad has Parkinson's. So sometimes he slurs his words and it's a little bit hard to understand him. So he just was like, no, here, you share it. I'll tell you what I just remember. So I'll just share what his thoughts and feelings were. So this, when he was this age, it was the first time he ever felt scared or unsafe. It was the first time ever that he could remember that his family or anybody he knew actually locked their doors at night. So that was, a lot of Nebraska is very much like that. Like we came from a big city, so we locked our doors because we're from Seattle. We're locking our doors. But there are a lot of people, when I was growing up, a lot of people didn't. In the small town my parents are from, that police, like the sheriff I mentioned, I think in North Dakota, like I was talking about our small town, he didn't even carry a gun. They weren't armed. Their police, like in that small town, were not armed. Also we're Mennonites, so we're pacifists. But this is just a totally different mindset for anybody in Nebraska. And the fact that just this like 19-year-old kid is causing all this uproar. So the governor called out the National Guard to patrol the streets. They ended up going door to door in Lincoln looking for them. Children were sent home from schools. Teenage boys with red hair were scared to go outside because they were afraid that people would think that they were Charlie. So the whole state was on edge. It just was a total, every like newscast, everything was on. And so my dad also remembers that because they were one of the only people in their town to own a TV.
Were they like the hot spot for everyone?
No, because Mennonites weren't allowed to watch TV. It was considered a sin. So they were the rebel family. My dad's house was kind of the rebel house. So they got to watch it on TV.
They got to watch the news.
Yeah. But everybody else listened to what was happening on the radio. And the radio was kind of used, that also is what kept like the police informed on what was going on, because there was just so much and everybody was searching. And so news shows were kind of everybody's way of finding out what had happened. Mm-hmm. A lot of people thought that Charlie and Carol Ann had headed south towards Kansas, because that was Kansas or Iowa would have been the closest other states if they wanted to get across state lines. And in one small town in Kansas, police were called to rush to the airport, but weren't told why. So they assumed that it was because somebody had captured Charlie. So when they arrived at the airport, they pulled their guns to be ready for anything, until they actually found out it was President Eisenhower, who had to be rerouted to land in this small town due to bad weather. He was actually traveling to Kansas for his brother's funeral at the time. So
just completely unrelated, stopped in this random spot.
Yeah. Yeah. And there are all these police with their guns drawn because they thought he was Charlie Starkweather. So I mean, posses were also formed. So one posse was formed in Lincoln, and there were so many people that showed up to be a part of this posse that they actually had to keep turning people away. Just to keep in mind, like, it was Holy Bessie. It would take another day after the killings at the Ward's house for people of Nebraska to sigh in relief. On January 29th, they got the news on the teletype machine that Charles Starkweather, 19, gunman sought in the Nine Slangs, was captured in the Badlands in Wyoming.
In Wyoming, okay. Yeah.
So Charlie hadn't headed south like everyone had thought. And actually, there had been some people who had called in some tips saying that they thought they had spotted him heading towards Wyoming, but the police didn't believe it. So take that as you will. They didn't think that he would travel clear across Nebraska, the 500 miles, to get to Wyoming. So
I don't see why. I mean, if he's willing to travel, they haven't shut down state borders. Like, no. Because do you need only certain states?
Well, they had closed down all the roads out of Lincoln and were checking car by car by car, but I think they had already gotten out by that point. So they knew what car to look for, because they knew what the Ward's car was. But, you know, there's a lot of really small roads in Nebraska. You can get places without being seen.
Yeah.
When they got to Wyoming, the Ward's car was apparently having some problems. And that's when Charlie spotted a car on the side of the road. He went and found a man sleeping in his car. His name was Merrill Colson. He was a shoe salesman from Montana. So this is the one time when we're actually going to be covering a case where the murderers kill in two states, because I was not going to do this story. So this is the one.
Okay.
So Charlie ended up shooting him, and then Carol Ann got in the back of the car. The problem was that Charlie didn't know how to release the emergency brake on this car, and he couldn't get it to start. As he was struggling with the car, another man ended up walking up to see what was the matter. Charlie pulled the gun on him and told him he would kill him if he didn't help get the car started. So the guy kind of looked in the car, saw this dead body on the passenger seat, and was like, oh, shit. So he was leaning in to help release the emergency brake when Carol ended up looking up behind her and saw a police car pull up. She ended up jumping out of the car and ran towards the policeman, screaming that he was going to kill her and that this was Charlie Starkweather and he needed to be stopped, that he was going to kill her. So she was complete hysterics at this time. Charlie quickly got the car started and a high-speed chase ensued, which ended up with the police shooting out the windows of his car and apparently some glass cut off the tip of his ear. And Charlie thought that he was going to bleed to death. So he ended up pulling over and giving himself up.
Because the tip of his ear, how bad did that bleed that he
thought? I don't know. Okay. So he was arrested. Charlie was found guilty of all of the murders, and at first, when he was interrogated, he stated that Carol Ann was innocent. However, he was quick to change his tune after Carol Ann wrote him a letter breaking up with him. After that, he stated she had helped him with everything, and Charlie was put to death in the electric chair on June 25th, 1959. So back in those days, Nebraska got it done pretty quickly.
Yeah, so, seems like it.
Carol Ann is a different story. So Carol Ann is one I have struggled with all of the years that I have been fascinated with this case. I think the main reason that this case sparked my interest is that when I first heard about it, I was Carol Ann's age. She was only 14 when all of this happened. Carol Ann has always stated that she was innocent. So that, like, there's just many problems with this case that make me, like, question what was going on. Mm-hmm. First off, when they caught the two of them, Carol Ann wasn't provided an attorney, even though she asked for one. The very first question she asked when Charlie was captured and she knew she was safe was where her parents were. The sheriff who was with her and his wife, many psychiatrists, doctors, all who first came in contact with her, so this was in Wyoming, were convinced that she was a hostage and not an active participant in everything. So inside of her jacket pocket, they found a note that had written on it, "Help police, please don't ignore." Carol Ann didn't understand at first that she was even going to be facing criminal charges. She thought that she was helping build a case against Charlie when they interviewed her. So even when they extradited her from Wyoming to Nebraska, I mean, she doesn't know anything. She's a 14-year-old little girl. And so they were kind of just like lying to her. The note that was mentioned that she wrote breaking up with Charlie, one of the sheriffs made her write it.
What did they hope to get out of that?
I don't, maybe him talking. I don't know. Maybe because he was saying that she didn't do it, and maybe they were like, oh, if he confesses, or if she breaks up, he'll. So it wasn't until she was sent back to Nebraska and she was placed under the eye of the sheriff. So Lancaster County is where Lincoln is, that she even found out. So like the wife, so every time she was transported, because she was a minor, they didn't even know what to do with her because they'd never had a minor that was being charged with first degree murder before. So they didn't know what the heck to even do. They didn't have juvenile halls back then. So a lot of times it was up to the sheriff's wife to watch her.
Oh, okay.
So the Lancaster sheriff's wife was talking to her. And so Carol Ann kept asking, like, what happened to my parents? Like, where are my parents? Why aren't my parents here? Kind of thing. And so she finally was like, you know what happened to them, Carol Ann? And Carol's like, no, I don't. And so she told him that they had been murdered. That's how she apparently, this is how Carol Ann says she found out that her parents had been murdered. And I guess under Nebraska state law back then, you didn't have a right to an attorney until after the preliminary hearing.
That doesn't seem to make sense.
So federal cases you do, which I think, I don't know, well, because she was a minor, but I mean, it could be considered a federal case because really he kidnapped her, even if she went along with him because she's a minor, but whatever. So I don't think that there was any way that Carol Ann could get a fair trial. So the news had covered the story like no other case in history. It was even headlines in Europe. Public opinion. She was already guilty. They had labeled her and Charlie the new Bonnie and Clyde. They were two young lovers that had gone on a killing spree. So Carol Ann was found guilty of first degree murder and given life in prison. Although in 1974, her prison sentence was reduced after the Supreme Court ruled about minors getting life sentences. Carol Ann stayed in prison for 17 years until she was paroled in 1976. So my uncle shared with me that she apparently, there was like a prisoner kind of like work program. So she apparently worked in the nursing home in my parents' hometown. While she was in prison. I can't actually confirm this, but I'm going to trust that he knows that it was true. He was the mayor of the town, so I would think he would know. But that she was really nice and like everybody really liked her. Just an interesting little side fact there. So Carol Ann to this day, so she's alive still, states that she is innocent. And just in January of 2020, she applied for a pardon to the Nebraska State Pardons Board, but she was denied with a 3-0 vote. So like the governor and a couple other people are on it. It didn't say why they denied her. I mean, obviously they probably still think she did it. But she could have gotten out of prison earlier, but she refused because she didn't, it would have been like she had to accept her role in things. And she's like, no, I didn't do this. So she stayed in prison longer than she even had to because she didn't want that label. And even to this day, like the reason why at 76 or 77 years old, she's asking for this pardon is because she doesn't want people to think that she's this murderer.
She did.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting that they automatically labeled her because I don't know, like nothing about this seems Like, why would she want to kill her parents? That doesn't mm-hmm. even make sense. Why mm-hmm. would she go on this huge killing spree? I know mm-hmm. it said it seemed like maybe if she was a murderer, she would have been more aggressive towards women. Because sometimes women can,
yeah.
I don't know, I feel like that's an MO. But, I mean, I don't see her doing this at all, especially with he has the past history of bullying and mm-hmm. of being very, very aggressive and needing to feel that he's superior. And
yes.
I mean, just the fact that he's short, a lot of that, like a lot of people
yeah.
would get that yeah. complex, especially yeah. back then, because mm-hmm. it's very like men have to look a certain way, women yeah. have to look a certain way. Not like today where it's like, okay, whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. And,
I don't know. It's just, I don't get how, what possible evidence could they have had that she did it other than his testimony? Yeah,
exactly. And like his, take, yes,
take his word for it.
Yes, exactly. And I just, yeah, they just, this is what they decided the like storyline was going to be. And they didn't want to look into or accept anything else. And I think back then we didn't really understand even Stockholm syndrome and like Patty Hearst and how she with the Sandinistas got involved with their like robbing banks and everything, or yeah. you know, there's just, I mean, so there's that. I mean, I'm guessing he was probably pretty manipulative and abusive. I mean, even the fact that he like took a job so he could be with her all the time by her school, I don't know, it just
yeah,
I just think she, I'm gonna say I think she's innocent, and I don't think that it's fair how the trial went. And I know her, I read a book called Pro Bono, and it was written by the grandson of her attorney, and her attorney had death threats, and it was just an awful time for his family. And he still, after she got sentenced, he still worked at getting her out. Like that was like his lifelong goal, was to get her exonerated.
Yeah. And it's interesting that they would deny the pardon. I don't know if they look at the evidence or look at what happened, because in today's day and age, you have to look at that and be like, okay, so all we're going off of is the murderer's testimony
yeah.
or this guy.
Well, and like, I think that one of the things that they think is like, she had so many opportunities to run away or to get away. I mean, they assume
she was a child.
Yeah, and exactly.
This man viciously murdered people in front of her. Where's she gonna go? And told her that he would murder her and probably threatened her family,
yeah.
who she didn't know was already dead.
Yeah. Like, so that's the other thing, is she was like, no, he told me that he had friends with my family, and that if I didn't go with him or do this, that he was gonna have them killed. It's just like, I just, that's such more of a believable narrative to me than his narrative. And the fact that even like when he was caught, like he first said that she hadn't done anything. And I think that like, that's the problem I have. And like, I've read books on her, I've read books on him, but like, if you look up this story, like on Murderpedia or Wikipedia, I mean, it really does portray them as like a Bonnie and Clyde kind of thing, and that like she was an active participant and this is the way it is. And
a lot of their stuff comes from news articles.
Yeah, exactly.
That's going to sell papers
if yeah.
you print that they're Bonnie and Clyde.
Yeah. So absolutely. I talked to my dad about it, and I kind of wanted to see like, because I mean, he grew up with this story and he knows and everything. And so I was like, what is your feeling on Carol Ann? And he is like, that she was a hostage and that there's no way that yeah. she committed those murders, that it was all Charlie. And I was like, exactly. So, I mean, even my dad, I mean, my dad's a pretty liberal guy and like has just grew up in a different frame of mind than a lot of people in Nebraska. But, you know, I think that that's a lot of cases the way it is. And even a lot of Starkweather's victims, family members, when she was going for this last pardon, were on her side. So there were some that are definitely not, but there are some that are. And it's so, yeah, I just feel horrible that's, yeah. I just don't feel that she did it. So that's just my opinion. I'm just going to say that. And other people are entitled to their opinions on this case, and nobody's truly going to know. But just with our knowledge of like how psychology works now compared to then, it just, the story seems different to me.
Yeah. And again, she was a child. Kids have been roped into doing things they don't want to do in multiple situations, mm-hmm. especially when you're threatening the safety of their family. What else are they going to do?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So that is my story that got me interested in true crime, Charlie Starkweather and Carol Ann Fugate.
Awesome. Thank you. That was worth the wait to hear about that. I had never heard about them before.
Yeah.
So that was a new story for me.
Oh, there's also something else kind of weird and interesting. So Martin Sheen, he played Charles Starkweather in a movie. He ended up actually buying Charlie Starkweather's headstone. So it's in Wyuka Cemetery, which is right in the center of Lincoln. So like he's one of very few people who have been put to death in by electric chair that actually has a headstone.
Why did he buy him a headstone?
Because he played him. I don't know. I thought it was kind of weird.
That is very weird. Okay. I mean, you do you, I guess.
Yep.
All right. Interesting. Well, thank you for sharing.
Yep.
My story this week, like we mentioned earlier, was a recommendation from your dad. So this is the case of, well, I'm going to go ahead and just, I know sometimes I'll name them after the killer and sometimes they're, I usually try to do it more so at the victims, but honestly, I'm going to go off of the case of Randy Reeves and I'm going to go off of his name and we'll get to why. So on March 29th, 1980, at 3:46 a.m., 30-year-old Janet Messner made a 911 call from her home in Lincoln, Nebraska. So again, with Lincoln, Nebraska.
Yep.
are there other cities in Nebraska? There are other cities.
Omaha.
There you go. Omaha. She told operators that she had been stabbed and she believed her friend was dead due to her stab wounds. When the police arrived, they noticed the address was to the Religious Society of Friends, which is a place where people of the Quaker religious faith would meet. So it was like their meeting house. And the Quaker religious faith comes up a bit in this story just because that's the families, but I'm not 100% familiar. Is there a huge Quaker population in Nebraska? Is that a thing?
There are some. It's not a huge population though, but yes, there are some. They're also pacifists, just so you know. And Benjamin Franklin was a Quaker.
Yeah. Janet had been the living caretaker there for the past 3 years, so she would kind of maintain the facility. And she was described as a kind, loving woman who believed in social justice. So like we talked about with the pacifists, they believed in everybody's rights. They were avid against the death penalty, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Her friend was Victoria Lamb, who's 28 at the time, and she was visiting from Oregon. She had recently moved to Oregon, so her and her 2-year-old daughter, Audrey, were stopping by to visit her friend. And Victoria was also 15 weeks pregnant, expecting her second child. Police officer Stephen Imes, who was the responding officer, entered to find Janet lying on the floor near the back of the house. She was being attended to by a few firemen, and they discovered that she had 7 stab wounds to the chest. Officer Imes asked her if she knew who had done this while they were trying to treat her wounds to get her transported, and she replied, Randy Reeves. She then told the officer about her friend and her daughter, so Officer Imes went upstairs to go look for them. There, he found the body of Victoria Lamb. She was lying face up and was only partially dressed. She had a fatal stab wound to her chest that had penetrated her pulmonary artery and another to her midsection, which had pierced her liver and some other organs. As the officer looked around the room, it was clear that a struggle had taken place. The floor was covered in blood. There were blood on the bed sheets. Lamps were thrown around. Papers were all over the place. These women definitely fought back. On the floor next to Victoria, there laid a wallet with Reeves's ID in it. And on the bed where all the blood was on the sheets, they found a pair of underwear that was also belonging to Reeves. They found on the side of the bed the serrated kitchen knife that was later determined to have Janet's blood on it. Officer Imes searched the bedroom when Victoria's 2-year-old daughter Audrey walked in from another room. Thankfully, Audrey was unharmed and had been asleep. It didn't really say if she was asleep through the whole thing, but I'm like, dang, that 2-year-old can sleep if there's a whole fight going on.
Yeah.
It doesn't really say how long the incident took place, but luckily Audrey was okay. Janet was taken to Lincoln General Hospital while she was in the exam room getting prepped for what I assume was surgery. They weren't really clear on it. She told the officer who was with her that she was raped and stabbed by Reeves, who she identified as her cousin. She didn't know how he got in, but she knew that he was by himself. No one else was with her. She cried and she said, "I don't know why Randy would do such a thing to me or to my girlfriend." Janet died in the hospital at 5:55 a.m. Randy Reeves was adopted from the Omaha Indian Reservation as a child by Donald and Barbara Reeves, and they lived on a farm near Central City, Nebraska, and they were distant cousins of the Mesner family. Mm-hmm. But they all practiced the Quaker religion, so that's how they were all close to each other, is that they were around a lot. So they were distantly related, but still related. Reeves had even visited Janet as a friend in her home multiple times. So they're thinking that's maybe how he found a spare key or knew that she would be there. Earlier that day, so I'm going to say the day before, but technically it's only like, I guess, hours before, because this happened in super early morning. Reeves and some friends from work had gone to a bar on Hastings, which I'm assuming is a street and not like a city, since their work was canceled due to weather. So they worked a construction job. And so since the work was canceled, they all started drinking. And just to let you know, this is 9 a.m. that their work got canceled.
There's not a lot to do in Nebraska. There's just not a lot to do.
They started drinking around 9 a.m. and then headed to a friend's house at 6 p.m. So they have been drinking all day. It did not specify that they literally did anything else in between that. They were at a bar and then went to one of the guys' houses to continue drinking. There, they stayed drinking a little bit more until they headed to another party, another friend's house. So the friend whose house they were at, he was like, "Hey, go on without me. You're welcome to come back here when that party's done, but I'm cool. I'm going to stay here." So everyone else left. And at this other party, Reeves drank some more and also ingested peyote, which for anyone who doesn't know is like a hallucinogenic drug. Mm-hmm. I'm not entirely sure how you ingest it, because I know, can't you drink it?
I think you can smoke it. I don't know about drinking it, but you maybe can drink it.
I felt like a tea. Maybe. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. So either way, he ingested peyote and had been drinking since 9 a.m. Mm. So at around 1:30 a.m., Reeves and the friend that he was with left the party, and Reeves had told him that he wanted to visit a girl. But at this point, he couldn't give his friend an address or even any coherent directions to where he needed to go. But the friend put it together. He got two street names out of him, dropped him off there. Which, let me just say, if your friend is so drunk or under the influence of something that they can't coherently give you an address to where they want to go, maybe don't take them where they say they want to go and take them home or to that other friend's house. I don't know. Either way, dropped him off on the corner of some streets.
Oh yeah, that's not safe, because if you're that incoherent, like, you probably are close to alcohol poisoning at some point and like could like puke on your own vomit. Like, there's just so many things. Like, you should be with people.
Yeah, you could choke, you could get hit by a car, you could get attacked, any sort of thing. So anyway, at 4:45 a.m., based on the description Janet had given to officers, so she's still at the hospital at this point, Reeves was arrested. Upon his arrest, Reeves had bloodshot eyes, blood on his clothes and hands, and his penis was hanging out of his pants. Ooh. He just kind of didn't really seem to be all there at that moment. At the police station, they tested his blood alcohol, and it was 0.149. So I never got how much he weighed, or like if he's a big guy or skinny guy, because I saw different pictures of him, so I don't know. But at that point, and especially because you would think, what, that's like 3 hours now after everything, and it didn't say that he continued drinking after that, that's still a pretty high blood alcohol level. So
yeah, that's very high.
Yeah. So during the trial, a psychologist could not give a specific diagnosis of if there was anything going on, because at this point the police had pretty much decided, like, okay, the witness admitted it.
Yeah.
Now both women are dead. He clearly has blood on her. There was semen found at the scene that I don't think they could get a exact match out of it, because they couldn't get a sample from him.
Oh.
But yeah, I don't even want to, because, yeah, I don't even want to go there. What, how they got, tried to get that sample, and they couldn't produce it on his own.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know what they did, but I did not want to Google that. But the blood was all over him. It was all over them. The winds, like, clearly knew who she had seen. Janet stabbed her. So during the trial, the psychologist could not give a specific diagnosis, but did say it was likely that he had a dissociative reaction due to all the peyote and the alcohol. Mm-hmm. And at this point, they had two psychologists. So they had one for the defense and one for the prosecution.
Yeah.
And so there was no other mental disease or defect, and Reeves even had an above average IQ and had attended college briefly before dropping out. Everybody who found out about what had happened were kind of shocked, because this didn't really seem like something he would do. He wasn't a violent person. He would drink. Obviously, that sounds like an issue for him, but with starting drinking at 9 a.m. and you're still not stopping, but he never got violent with anybody. So both the psychologists could speak to the events of that night and couldn't agree on how the drugs and alcohol played a role in the murders. So on one side, they were saying, okay, yeah, he both could agree that he was like under the influence, but either he was too under the influence to remember right from wrong, or he wasn't, basically. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if he was so drugged up and so drunk that he couldn't tell right from wrong or know right from wrong, wouldn't that have incapacitated him from committing the murders in the first place? Because if you're that gone that you can't even think, most likely you're passed out. Or like you said, you're really close to alcohol poisoning at this point. How can you like do this? So they were trying to argue against that, was the main thing, because obviously the defense was like, oh yeah, he had no idea of right from wrong. Mm-hmm. He was probably hallucinating. There was all of this. But then the prosecution was like, well, either if he was that messed up, he wouldn't have been able to do it in the first place, or very easily, probably the women could have fought him off. If he was so drunk, they probably just would have needed to push him and he would have fell. They were going off of that.
Yeah.
So ultimately,
I mean, but people have blackout drunks and like, I mean, and they do all sorts of shit and they don't remember it. So, you know,
that's true.
And like people on bath salts and all the crazy shit they do, you know, so
that's true. Yeah, but then too, and then again,
not to excuse it, not to excuse it or say in any shape, you know, but yeah.
Yeah. I also don't know too much about peyote.
I don't either.
The effects of it, like how intrigued are the hallucinate?
Yeah.
Hallucinations, if I can talk, or like what it causes you to do. Also, too, anyone with that much alcohol in their system, though, I feel like even if you were blackout, that would still be bringing you
down. Yeah.
But I don't know. Ultimately, in 1981, Reeves was found guilty on both counts, and he was sentenced to death for each murder count. Reeves started the appeals process, and he had a lot of different things. So this was going on for a while, and the execution was stayed when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the Nebraska Supreme Court didn't follow procedure correctly in 1991 during one of the appeals. The main appeal argument that ultimately negated his execution sentence was that Reeves had been the victim of a death penalty sentence that discriminated against minorities. Because remember, he was born on the Omaha Indian Reservation and was adopted. And his attorney brought a lot of evidence showing that minorities are given the death penalty way more often than their white counterparts.
Yes.
And so that was their argument, is that it discriminated against him. And they could use that argument because Nebraska had just passed that equal rights into their constitution. They had passed the Equal Rights Amendment. Mm-hmm. With nobody thinking that this was going to affect anything of this, definitely not getting people out of the death penalty, they just assumed it was kind of like this formality that, oh, we already have equal rights, so we're just going to add this and now it's on paper, but now they can use that. It's also interesting, as I was reading through it, that mainly Victoria's family, so her husband Gus and her daughter Audrey specifically, were very strong advocates to remove Reeves from death row. So they didn't want him to be put to death, whereas her parents were very adamant of like, no, he needs to be gone now and we need to get rid of him. Janet's family, it didn't give me too much about what their thought process was. I think it was also kind of a mixed bag, but I think her parents also just decided they didn't want the death penalty for him either. So just like we talked about with the Mennonites being pacifists, like you said, the Quakers are also pacifists, so they don't believe in that. Just on that, I thought it was very interesting because the amount of forgiveness that you have to be able to give someone is incredible. To actively fight to get the death penalty removed from the person who killed your wife and your mother, that's intense.
Yeah.
So in 2001, the Nebraska Supreme Court vacated the death sentence and instead sentenced him to 2 life terms. Reeves would die in prison from terminal cancer that had spread to his liver and some other organs at the age of 60 in May of 2016. Mm-hmm. And so I know my stories are always super short, maybe because I talk really fast, but
no.
I did want to talk about this because the reason that I wanted to kind of name this case when I'm talking about it as Randy Reeves versus the victims is because I'm not entirely like, yes, I believe he committed the crime, but it's an interesting line as to whether or not he's kind of like a victim too, in a way of making these bad choice or like taking these drugs that and we forced him to, but that the drugs played an unintended effect on what he did.
Because
he was throughout everything, he was always very remorseful and regretted what he did. But he owned up to it and was like, yeah, this is what happened. I don't know. I can't remember anything and I can't remember doing this. He was very remorseful throughout the whole thing. And so it's kind of unfortunate because he's not like, he's the bad guy, but not in the same way that all of our other stories have like a clear cut, like, you know, this dude is a murderer or this person is a crazy person or this person did this. Or even in the story that we told about Andrew Sadik, where the police were in the wrong, like they intentionally knew that something bad would happen. This was an unfortunate case of drugs not mixing right and it causing this, which is a very scary concept to think that something like this could lead to that. And especially too, that it ended up being his cousin and it ended up being her friend, and thinking that maybe that was the only place that he could coherently think of, not because he was looking for a girl, but maybe even because he was looking for support or comfort, or like, hey, this is just a place to crash, you know what I mean,
or somebody he would recognize, or
and so it was an interesting thing to me to not be so upset at him, you know, or not to be like, oh, this guy's such an asshole, because it's just a way, and you're nodding because you knew what this story was. And so it was interesting for me to read up on that. And the reason that I got a lot of that information was because the court case and the court document is actually online. So I was able to kind of read through all of the notes and see kind of exactly what happened from the officer statements and those kinds of things, which was nice because usually we don't get those sorts of things in a lot of the cases. I think the last time I was able to get the court notes was probably our Vegas episode.
So
It was interesting to me though, to not be like, obviously I'm very heartbroken for the victims and heartbroken, especially too, because Janet had to die thinking that her cousin did that to her.
Yeah.
Or knowing that he did that to her and not really getting to hear the other circumstances in play, and that Victoria had to die just for visiting her friend, probably defending herself, defending her daughter.
Yeah.
And I can only imagine that the women were trying to reason with him because they knew him and tried to talk to him, and to be so gone like that. Or even too, what was he hallucinating? Like, what did he possibly think was the threat there?
Yeah.
Did he break into the house and scare them? So then by them trying to defend themselves from an intruder, it scared him. I mean, so many different situations could have happened.
Yeah. Yeah. And with that, and also, and I think that this plays a part in like kind of the racial bias, because Nebraska, I mean, I'm from there, so I feel like I have a pretty good understanding of what it's like to live there. And I went to a high school where there was only one African-American girl in my school. Everybody else was white. And there is, you know, there's definitely, there is a bias against Native Americans in a lot of sense there, for sure. But, you know, when you think of that, and what dictates death penalty and this does not sound like a premeditated murder. You know, it's mm-hmm. not that, and there's so many extenuating circumstances that it's just, okay, yeah, like he did murder them, but it's also what constitutes death penalty. I don't know. But yeah. I mean, I do have a tie. Randy Reeves was the very first death penalty case that I went and protested when I was, I think, 14 years old. So okay. he was scheduled to be put to death, and there was a stay of execution, but we were actually outside of the prison the okay. night he was supposed to be put to death, peacefully protesting. So my family are we are very involved in social justice. And so this was not my first protest by any means, but it's the first one that I asked my dad to go to with me and my choice going. And it was probably one of the scariest moments of my life because there was a lot of animosity towards us. And as I said, I am a pacifist, so I'm very anti the death penalty. I had a glass bottle that was thrown at my face from across. So there was us on one side and pro death penalty people on the other side, and there was like just a kind of little fence, like little yeah. rope separating us, and they were very violent and very angry towards us, and we just sat there. They were screaming and just very profane, and we were just there and we were singing. And I don't know if you ever saw the movie Dead Men Walking. Mm-mm. But anyway, it stars Sean Penn and Susan Sarandon, but it's based off of a true story about a nun who's very, and I can't remember her name, but it'll come to me at some point, probably after we're done recording, but she's very known for being an advocate against the death penalty. And so she was there, and some of Randy Reeves' family. And so it was just a really emotional thing. And then there was a stay of execution. So yeah, it was just, so I went to a couple other protests there, but yeah, that was my scariest moment. But like, so that's when I think of that, and the fact that there was such a racial thing, you know, charge mm-hmm. there, and that he did get the stay of execution when not all of them do. But yeah, yeah, that was just, so that's like the case. My picture was actually in the paper for that. So the Lincoln wow. Journal Star. But yeah, it was just a really interesting time, and something like my dad has just taught me to do is stand up for things that I believe are right. And while not maybe mm-hmm. not everybody will agree with me, I know that some other podcasts that we listen to are avidly against the death penalty. And one of the reasons being that you need to be 100% sure 100% of the time if you're putting yeah. somebody to death, and how can you be?
Yeah. And I go back and forth with it. I mean, with how much error there is and how mm-hmm. many cases are on death row, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, just kidding, you didn't do it, that wasn't mm-hmm. you,
yeah,
that you've been wrongfully convicted, and there's so much error there. So yeah, you have to be there 100% time. But even with the cases that are like, no, obviously this person did it, like mm-hmm. no, without a shadow of a doubt this is what happened, mm-hmm. I still find myself questioning it, because thinking if that was somebody, not the murderer, but the victim, mm-hmm. was somebody that I loved or somebody that I cared about, would I want that person to be put to death? Like, it doesn't bring my loved one back.
Yeah.
And also too, I'm in the camp of like, so what? They get to die mm-hmm. peacefully and fine, and they don't yeah. have to think about it anymore, and they don't have to remember, but I have to live with this. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Yeah. I just, and we talk about it a lot when we talk about the strength of families of these victims
yeah.
and how they can pull together. And honestly, don't know if that's something I could ever do. Like I was binge watching a TV show the past couple of days, and then my favorite character got killed and I lost it. I was so mad that
yeah.
I wanted nothing but revenge for that person who killed her. And this was a character on a TV yeah. show. So to imagine someone I cared about, I don't know if I would have that strength to forgive them, or even have that strength to, mm-hmm. I don't know, like to get past that. I don't know. And then again, we go back to, would I want them to just die, or would I want them yeah. to have to sit there and remember what they did for the rest of their life?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. It's a
and I also think that a lot of times, and especially like when we talk about serial killers and like just even like spree killers or anybody, learning about their minds and like interviewing them mm-hmm. so that we can learn how to make changes and do better for people in the future. And if you don't have that opportunity, it's like so much is mm-hmm. lost. And mm-hmm. so like, that's a frustrating thing too, because look at how, you know, how far we've come in profiling and figuring out people and the way their brains work. And a lot of that is interviews and talking to people. And so I think mm-hmm. that plays a key role in it for me, and that we can't be sure 100% of the time. So I don't think we should put anybody to death. I also, what do we get out of it? There's so many things. There's so many questions. So and maybe I'll cover, because talking about that, when I interned for the National Campaign to End the Death Penalty when I was 19, 20 years old, when I lived in Chicago, and the number of people who are unjustly, this was in 2000, so that were wrongfully convicted and put on death row in Illinois is staggering, and it also plays a lot of it, plays race, and so... Yeah. There are a lot of stories that I could share and tell just with those men that we would interview and talk to about their cases. And so I think that that's just really sparked my passion on being so anti-death penalty, is just their mm-hmm. stories and how unjust and how they were just browbeaten and given not a fair trial. So mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have issues with the justice system as a whole.
Oh, absolutely.
There's a lot of injustices and stuff, and I think reform needs to happen, and mm-hmm. and especially too with everything going on right now in the world, which is, by the time this episode airs, has hopefully come to some type of change. But the protests that are happening right now for police brutality and things like that mm-hmm. I've sparked a lot of conversations with people in my life, and even too with my husband, who's white. So asking questions like, well, are we going to have conversations about what, like with our kids mm-hmm. about how to interact with police? Cause we were watching a video on African-American parents talking to their kids about what do you do when a cop comes, or what do you say when a cop pulls you over? And I had to tell them, we are going to have, not to the extent that the African-American community does, but to some extent, because my brother has been pulled over multiple times without any cause, just mm-hmm. because he looks Mexican.
Yeah.
Even this was when he had his long hair, so when he looked Native American.
Yeah.
And it's something that, me and my brother were taught these things and the things that are wrong in the justice system, and things aren't always fair for people of color, any person of color.
No.
Things are not fair, especially him being, and with this case with Reeves being Native American, mm-hmm. if it had been a white man mm-hmm. who, again, drank all day, if it had been one of his friends who sounded like they were white guy, I mean, mm-hmm. would they have gotten the death penalty, or would it have been?
Exactly.
You get life sentences. This isn't.
Yeah.
Honestly, this almost even sounds like murder too, I guess.
Yeah.
Maybe even a manslaughter, because he wasn't of sound mind to make those decisions. I mean, shoot, he didn't even zip up his pants. Like, he wasn't, when they found him, he was just kind of wandering. So almost too, like, would they have even gotten the same sentence that he did?
No.
For these murders?
No.
Yeah.
No, they wouldn't have. Yeah, that's the issue. So it was interesting because I had my nephews over the other day. And so one of my nephews, he's Cambodian, but he's very dark complected. And so we were sitting and we were scanning to see like a movie or we could watch. And like randomly on the Disney Plus, there was this movie called Color of Friendship. And so it had a little African-American girl. Okay. I've never seen it. I've never heard of it.
Disney Channel originally from.
So I'm guessing it has to do something about a white girl and this African American girl becoming friends, and there's color of their skin. I'm guessing, because
the white girl's from South Africa and the black girl's from America. But this is during the apartheid. And mm-hmm. so, because the African American girl, her dad's in the government and stuff, and I can't remember what he does. I think he's a congressman. And so they're like, let's get a student from Africa, an exchange student. This will be really great, and we can bond because these are our people.
Oh, and then they get a white girl.
and then they get a white girl from America. And it's such a good movie, so I hope you guys watched it.
Or we didn't. You because, should. But like, we didn't even read what it was about, but I just went off of the picture, and I was like, well, I'm sure it's something about how is it okay for this white girl and this African-American girl to be friends? And my nephew, Emmett, he's 9, he is like, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. And I'm like, why? And he's like, because it doesn't matter. Like, of course they should be friends. That is so stupid. And he's like, look at our family. It doesn't matter. Skin does not matter. And he's like, and that makes me just so angry. And I'm like, it should make you angry. I mean, and that's good. And I'm like, so if you come across people that think that it does matter, you need to say something. But it was just like this moment of like, I'm so proud of you. I love you so much. And kids are so innocent. And obviously it shows that racism is learned.
It is. And so it is 100% learned.
Yeah.
And yes. So for anyone out there, and you and your nephews, definitely watch The Color of Friendship on Disney Plus. I grew up with it. It was a Disney Channel original movie. I loved it. I love Disney Channel original movies.
Yeah.
Some of them get so deep. Mm-hmm. And like this one was, because one, it teaches you about the apartheid, which not everybody knows happened.
Yeah. But,
and then two, like there are white people in South Africa.
And, yeah. Yep.
But just that they overcome this because the racism that was so prevalent at that time shows, because and just to give you a little bit, in the first like time she meets the family, they see her. So they're looking for her. And she goes, oh, are you here to take me to this family? And the mom instantly recognizes that the girl she was taught to be racist or anything,
yeah.
That they were the help.
She goes,
I'll take your stuff. And the girl's like, the daughter is very confused because in America, she wasn't, her dad's a congressman. They live in a nice neighborhood. Like she wasn't experiencing that sort of stuff. And to have this racism thrust in there. And then too, it's just such a good movie. And yeah, you're right. They do end up becoming friends, but even more so than that, they learn from
each other. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, because at first the girl wants to go home, and then eventually she's like, you know what, like, I'm going to stay and we're going to do this. And so they end up learning from each other about the rights and wrongs of everything the apartheid was about. And also too about race. And they also, the mom takes them to places in America and shows like, this is, I mean, still around. And how sad that this is a movie from... like, I don't know, late 90s, early 2000s, and we're still talking about this.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Injustices.
Oh, I know. No.
Happening, and it's enough to just make you want to pull your hair out.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
So frustrating.
So, but no, instead, we did not watch that movie. We watched an equally moving educational movie, The Princess Bride.
I love The Princess Bride. That's also a good movie.
But can I tell you this? So they're watching it. They've never seen it before. And spoiler alerts, if anybody hasn't seen this movie, just in case.
If you haven't, pause it. Go
pause
watch
it. Don't listen. Yeah. Yeah. And then come back, because it's the greatest movie, one of the greatest movies of all time. But Princess Buttercup's been kidnapped. And so they're heading. And so they're climbing up, you know, the cliffs of insanity. And so Emmett's like, so who's the guy following him? And I'm like, you'll have to wait and see. And then I go to make popcorn. And so while Indigo and him are sword fighting, my mom tells them who the Men in Black is. And I'm like, Mom, you ruined it. You gotta let him so that when he falls down the hill and says, as you wish, you realize who it is. Oh, I was so mad at her.
Oh my goodness.
And then as I was quoting it the entire way the movie was playing, which was probably annoying, but I didn't care.
It's such a great movie.
Oh, it is.
Inigo Montoya.
You killed my father. Prepare to die.
Oh, that movie's great.
So for a lighter side of discussion, yes. So that's what we watched. You know, the last time they were over, we watched The Goonies. That last time we did a movie night. So this night we watched Princess Bride. I'm giving them
we're going to watch Color of Friendship.
Yeah, we'll watch Color of Friendship. Seeing as I haven't seen it either.
Yeah, it's a good movie. I like it. So that was my story and why I was kind of going back and forth with it. I think ultimately there were three victims in this situation, although Yeah, I mean, he made some choices, but nobody should feel like their choices like that are gonna, I mean, and again, that's why we have to think twice about every action that we make, because apparently things like this can happen. And
yeah,
I mean, that's something he literally had to live with for the rest of his life, is that one day off of work, partying with the guys too hard, and yeah, what happened?
Yeah, changes your life completely. So, well, thank you for sharing that story. I'm glad my dad suggested it for you.
Me too. It was a good story. It was a good, it was an interesting case. Yeah. It's an important story to share and to talk about.
Yeah, it creates a lot of dialogue.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So now it's time for our super fun state facts.
And cities.
All right. So do you want to start with your city or my city first?
You could start with your city, because then I'll do city, then my city and state.
Okay. Yes, because you are all about the state facts today.
Yeah.
So my case took place in Lincoln, Nebraska, which is the capital of Nebraska, for anyone who didn't know. And so partially because of something I looked up online, and partially because Amber shared the story of being served McRibs in high school. The McRib from McDonald's, which is that sandwich that comes around every so often and they make a big deal about it.
It's like a cult following.
It's actually credited its invention to a professor at the University of Nebraska named Roger Mandigo. He was an animal science professor, and he is credited with the technology that made the McRib possible, which is basically just to extract, using salt to extract the proteins from the muscle of the pork, and it holds it all together, and they can make it in whatever shape they want. So he created it in the shape of like a pork chop. So it's almost like sausage making, just without the casing, is what you're eating. When you eat a McRib, you just think about that. So yeah, so it was in the shape of a pork chop, but McDonald's was like, nope, make it look like the boneless part of a back rib. And so they reshaped it, which is why Mandigo doesn't think that he's the father of the McRib, which is kind of what he's been come to known as, because he's like, hey, I just made the processes work. They came up with all the rest of the stuff. So yeah, so that was him. And despite his modesty, his invention of what's called restructured meats was important enough to earn him induction into the Meat Industry Hall of Fame, which I didn't know existed. Week, not like a Hall of Fame I want to be in, among big names like Colonel Sanders and yes! Wendy's founder Dave Thomas.
Oh.
So there you go. That is my Lincoln fact, is the McRib. So whenever you see the McRib, you just think of Professor Mandigo and how he made that all possible by mixing meat together with salt.
That's right. That's why we got the McRibs in high school, even when they weren't in season. I don't know what you call it.
Eat a lot of McRibs? Do you like McRibs?
No. It reminds me of high school, which wasn't my favorite time of life. So, so, but just randomly, yeah. So, well, thank you for sharing that fact. Okay, so my city fact also is Lincoln. So, two times Lincoln. There are not a lot of big cities in Nebraska. So, I was really trying to decide which Lincoln fact I could use. I thought about talking about, so I'll share it anyway. So, Lincoln is the home of the Cornhuskers, so the University of Nebraska, and on any given Saturday that football happens there, so when fans go to Memorial Stadium, Memorial Stadium becomes the third largest city in Nebraska. Just the stadium.
Do the Cornhuskers have like a chant? Do they have a thing?
There's no place like Nebraska. That's their theme song, or their school song. Go Big Red. So go Big Red. Now I don't know why, but they randomly, like during the football games, hold up a left shoe. I'm not sure, that didn't exist when I was in school there, so I don't know.
Okay. Yeah,
but
because you know how some of them have little like cheers that they say.
Yeah. I didn't go to football games there. They were sold out. Oh. So they've had they're the record holders for the most sold out games in a row.
Wow.
Yeah. So if the you don't like to be in Nebraska when the Cornhuskers lose because the whole state mourns and everybody's in a bad mood. But my Lincoln fact is going to be about, since it's the Capitol City, is about the Capitol building. So the Capitol building, there was a decree that no building could be taller than it, because they wanted it to be seen from distances. The Midwest, if you go out, it's flat as all get out, so you can see for miles and miles and miles because there's nothing there. So the Capitol building has an unfortunate shape, and it has been dubbed the penis of the plains because it looks like a giant penis sticking out of the ground. I'll put a picture.
Thank you. Please put a picture of that. That's hilarious.
So, and then it's really funny because we're the Cornhuskers. So on top is a sower, which is a guy flinging his seed. So yeah. So nothing like Nebraska. So that's my fun city fact for Lincoln, besides also that. But yeah, I always think it's hilarious. So my brother and I knew it as penis of the plains. My dad knows it as penis of the prairie. So either one, whatever. But maybe it's a generational thing. I don't know. But that's maybe. So that's my fun city fact. So I'll have the state fact since it's my home state. And I was also debating on what I should share from my home state. I could tell you that Kool-Aid was invented in Nebraska. So for a really long time, that was the state drink. Apparently, like they changed
specific flavor or just Kool-Aid in general?
Just Kool-Aid in general. But I guess I was looking it up just to make sure it was still the state drink, and it's not. They changed it to milk.
Ugh. Ew.
I know. Who drinks
milk? Who just drinks milk?
I know. I can't. I'm not a two-year-old.
Unless you have cookies or, like, some sort of, like, you're drinking it at the end of your cereal. Who just sits there and is like, you know what's good? A glass of the milk.
Yeah. And I'm like, okay. So, cause they're like, well, because of all the dairies in Nebraska, and I'm from Nebraska and I don't associate Nebraska with dairies. That's like Wisconsin.
I feel like Wisconsin, cause they're literally like the cheeseheads, like yeah. That's the thing. Like the cheese and dairy industry. Yeah.
So whatever. So I still think Kool-Aid is, but it also, Nebraska is where Arbor Day started for the United States, and it was started in 1872 by J. Sterling Morton in Nebraska City, which is over, it's kind of close to Omaha, and this is a holiday which is meant to recognize and support the planting of trees. And Nebraska, there have been over 1 million trees planted in honor of Arbor Day.
That's awesome. And
I can tell you for a fact, I planted a number. They would always give us at school at every like little thing, like a little sapling, like, I don't know, like pine tree. So like we planted them. So outside my grandpa's house, we planted a number of them. And so there were like, they're deceased now, but at the house still is there. And so you can go see, and like, there's a number of trees that like us grandkids have planted that are still up and around. And
that's so, cool.
Yeah. So thank you, Nebraska, for starting Arbor Day and supporting the tree population, which is always very important.
Yeah, and Arbor Day, that's in September?
April 24th.
I was way off. What was I thinking of? I don't know what I was thinking.
Earth Day,
maybe?
Probably.
Yeah, Earth Day. Okay.
So that is my interest fact for Nebraska. There was a lot. I was also going to talk about, there is a thing called Carhenge. It's kind of in the middle of Nebraska, and it's this guy who had a whole bunch of old Cadillacs that he didn't know what to do with that didn't run. So he painted them all a kind of cement gray color and then created a replica of Stonehenge from Cars.
Huh.
I have pictures of it. I could put them up too. I've gone there. That we also went there on my wonderful 16th birthday trip.
Oh God.
When we
whenever this quarantine is officially lifted, we'll, whatever birthday's coming up for you, we'll just do a makeup trip for your 16th birthday. Whatever you had wanted to do, we'll do that.
I just wanted to hang out with my friends and get my driver's license.
Oh,
was all I wanted to do.
Around.
Yeah. Had to wait weeks because we went on this long trip. Dang it.
Nice. All right. So thank you for listening to us talk about the state of Nebraska and the two cases we had. Thank you again for listening. Make sure you like and follow us on Facebook and Instagram at SOM Podcast. Like always, if you have any corrections or want to share anything with us, just say hi, give us new stories, anything like that. Email us at stateofmurderpodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you guys. Remember to stay safe out there, everybody, and love each other and take care of each other, because we are all people on this earth and we need to be united together.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes, for sure. So next week, where are we headed?
Kansas.
We're headed to Kansas. So there's no place like home.
Oh no. My brother says that's the asshole of America.
Okay. So we're going to talk more about that. Maybe we'll figure out what Kansas. Sorry to anybody who
doesn't know Kansas. Which I'm sure there are, because I went to college in Kansas.
Sorry.
The sunflower state.
I like how the asshole of the, what did you say, of the Midwest? Or the
of the United States.
Of the country.
Yeah.
Is next to that giant penis in Nebraska.
It goes well together. They go hand in hand.
There you go. Nebraska and Kansas. All right, guys. So, again, thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.
All right. Bye.
Bye.